Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. Thank you for joining us this morning. Our guest today is Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. You may recall that Dyer has announced his retirement from the department. But before we get to our guest today, we'd just like to take a moment to reflect back on the program we had last week in honor of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Many of us over the weekend probably watched so many of the tributes and also the unveiling of the monument in Washington, D.C. I'd like to know what you thought about that and just what were your thoughts on that day as you maybe went to church or gathered with your friends or watched one of the many tribute programs. You can call me here at 559-275-8989 or 800-224-8989 or online at kvpr.org. And I know one of the things that kind of struck with me was everyone else. I thought about what I was doing that day and where I was that day. And I can remember getting ready to go to work as a reporter at Channel 30. And my family coming to tell me, or my kids coming to tell me, you're probably going to have a busy day today, because we were all watching. And at the time, we didn't really know what we were saying, just like everybody else at home, till it dawned on us just the magnitude of what we were seeing. And when I took a look at the monument today, this weekend, and the unveiling of the monument, it just struck me the idea of having the waterfall flowing over those names, like they said, like tears. So for a lot of us, it may have been the 10th anniversary, but it's something that we should look up back on from time to time and really, really never forget. And joining me now is Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. As I mentioned, in June, the chief announced that he was retiring after 32 years with the department and 10 years as the chief. He is here to address a number of issues, and he will take your calls as well. You can call at 800-224-8989 or 275-8989 or online at kvpr.org. And before we get to our conversation today, Chief, I'd just like to ask you for yourself, your thoughts about 9/11 as we just acknowledged the program we had last week.
Well, I think September 11th is a date that we need to all remember as Americans. It was a date that we felt vulnerable. And it's a date that I know that as what we look at in terms of law enforcement and first responders is something that we need to always be prepared for, and our communities need to be prepared for. I attended the event over at Schneider Electric or Pelco this weekend, and it was the most well-attended event that we'd had since we started that 10 years ago. And it really, what touched my heart the most was seeing some of these young kids that were out there wearing military uniforms, and I'm talking about 6- and 7-year-old kids, and waving American flags. And that's what our country's all about, and it's what I hope that our American people will continue to remember.
You know, you mentioned a first responder. You are a first responder. And when we look back at the 32 years you've spent with the department, I'm dating us both here, Jerry, because Jerry and I go back a long way. We've talked about that before. I was a new reporter at Channel 30, and you were still on the streets.
I was a sergeant at that time, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Well, when you look back at your career, you know, there are many highs and there are many lows during your tenure. And for the most part, we did see a decrease in crime, but we also witnessed an increase in officer-involved shootings. You know, the department saw you know, other officers filing lawsuits against you and the department, alleging discrimination and favoritism. You know, let's make this a two-part question. First, tell me, how do you deal with the criticism that's leveled at you? You know, you're in the hot seat, so you're the person that's going to get it all the time. And as a chief and as someone who is the administrator, the manager of a huge department, how do you handle that?
Well, first off, anytime you get into a leadership role, you have to accept the fact that there's going to be criticism. And if you are not able to handle criticism, then you should not become a leader. And you have to know that when in our organization, when you have over 1,000 employees, that employees from time to time are going to make mistakes, especially in our line of work. When we handle 1,150 calls a day and we have to come across individuals that are facing mental illness, people that are emotional, people that are under the influence of alcohol and drugs. And we're the ones that are called in to make sense of all of that. Our officers are the ones that are confronted with people that are aggressive, angry, people that perhaps are going through some problems within their personal life, their family life. And so when an officer shows up, they have to be able to make some immediate sense of everything and bring a sense of calm. And there's a potential for officers to use force, to use deadly force. You spoke about the increase in officer-involved shootings, and the reality is this year we've had our lowest number of officer-involved shootings than I can remember in many years. We've had 4 officer-involved shootings involving 4 officers total with a total of 5 rounds fired. I think that speaks highly to the discipline of these officers out there, especially this year, because we've seen an increase, a 30% increase in assaults against officers. People are becoming more violent, more aggressive, more angry with government, more angry with officers who are the most visible. And so it stands to reason when you're faced with those types of confrontations and situations, there's a potential for officers to have to use force and, unfortunately, deadly force. And when you talk about some of the internal issues that we face or any law enforcement agency faces, when you're faced with severe budget constraints in an organization and you're having to restructure your department frequently to accommodate those, we've lost 370 employees in the last 2.5 years, 100 of those being police officers. And with that, you have employees are having to increase their own workload. You know, we're not like the private sector. In business, when revenues go down, you lay off employees. And the reason revenues go down is because your business is decreasing, meaning your workload is decreasing. Well, that's not true in law enforcement. We're losing people, but our workload is going up, which is creating more of a stress and more of a strain on our officers and our civilian employees who are having to take on more duties, more responsibilities. And when that happens, there's an increased stress within an organization, and it does impact morale.
You know, we want to get to that. We want to discuss that a little bit more because you're not only the chief, you are the administrator of that department. So you deal with budgets all the time. But before we go on, we really would like to know from you, just what are you most proud of as a chief?
Well, when I became the chief, I set forth the number one goal in the organization for all of us was to never lose a police officer in the line of duty. I've seen the impact that has on law enforcement agencies in a community when you do lose an officer. And some of the things are outside of our control, but many of the things are inside of our control. One of those is I've vowed to provide adequate staffing levels to our officers in the field. When they call for an assisting unit, they get one timely. That we provide them with the very best equipment, safety equipment that we can and we have, and that we provide them with the best training. And we recently built a training center, a regional training center that allows our officers not only to be able to be trained in firearms and tactical searches, but also emergency driving. And so that is the thing that I'm most proud of in terms of keeping our officers alive. But the other thing is the fact that we have been able to decrease the number of people killed in our city through traffic collisions. Back in 2002, we had 52 people killed in traffic collisions in our city. We more than tripled our traffic safety efforts, our enforcement efforts in our city. And I'm proud to say today that number has been cut in half. And when you add those numbers up over the years, there's about 140 fewer families that had to bury a loved one in our city as a result of a traffic collision.
That was one of the things you really stepped up in this department, and it was traffic enforcement. And people may not think that, you know, that's a big area, but when you look at the number of people who die every year from car accidents.
We have 3.5 months left in this year, and there's 18 people that have died in traffic collisions. And when you compare that to where we were in 2002 and before, averaging around 50 to 52 a year, and the people that are dying in traffic collisions are folks like you and me. People that are being killed in homicides oftentimes are associated with a certain lifestyle. They're involved in gangs or drugs or in and out of prison. That's not always the case because we do have innocent people killed. But the people that are dying in traffic collisions are folks like you and me and our families that are driving through an intersection, minding their own business, when someone runs a red light, often in times intoxicated, and takes the life of an individual, a loved one. And so I'm proud of the fact that we've been able to reduce those traffic fatalities in our city by more than half. And behind every number is a family.
Exactly. Now, part of the reason you chose to retire at this time, and you've been very public with that, was having to do with the retirement benefits and this whole formula that I definitely don't understand. But, you know, many public servants can retire today with very generous benefits, oftentimes taking home the same amount of their salaries. Now, some believe that maintaining those high level of benefits for public employees has really hurt the local budgets, the cities and counties. And they just can't afford it anymore. Also, the whole idea, trying to get public servants to pay more into those benefits, that's been a tough battle as well. Some might think it's all too generous, especially at a time like this.
Sure. That's very reasonable. First off, my decision to announce my retirement coincided with a long-term plan that I had, and that was to do 10 years as a police chief in this city. The fact that the retirement system, what we call our deferred retirement option plan, made an adjustment triggered that retirement announcement probably a few months early. And so we're not talking about very much in terms of time that I would have been here anyway. But the reality is, and I know about those stories where people retire what they, you know, the same pay that they made when they were working. That's not my case. And in fact, not even close. But the reality is the city of Fresno's retirement system is much different than the state's retirement system, although people seem to paint everyone with the same brush. And here's the difference. The state retirement system is if you're in law enforcement, you do – it's called 3% at 50. If you do 30 years and you're 50 years of age, you retire at 90% of your salary. Well, the public safety system we have in Fresno, the city of Fresno has their own retirement system. It's 55% at 50, even if you do 30 years. So there's a vast difference. Our retirement system is not the same as Clovis. If I was a police chief in Clovis leaving right now, I'd be retiring at 96% of my salary. Well, I'm not. And the same with the sheriff's department or the same with any state entity. So we're not the same. In fact, as a result of that, the city of Fresno has the number one funded retirement system in the state of California and top five in the United States. I know that. I was on the retirement board for a while. And so we're very proud of it. And the reason that we're the most funded is because they pay out the least amount of benefits. And so when you hear about the drain that is happening in government today, it's not the city of Fresno's retirement system, but we happen to have our people painted with the same broad brush that they're using to paint the state of California.
Do you think if we were at a different time and let's say we weren't facing these economic problems that we've been dealing with now for years, that this would be such a big topic? And I want to give the folks at home a chance to, if this is a topic you're interested in and you want to jump right in, please give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 275-8989, or you can join us online at kbpr.org. That this would be such a huge issue?
The issue of?
Of pensions.
Well, pensions should be a huge issue of discussion, because when you look at what's happening at the state level, you have the state each year having to pay in more and more and more money to pension systems. So it should be on the table, especially in these difficult economic times. But what concerns me is that it's when people are talking about pensions, there's a tendency to demonize government employees for getting those pensions. And I think what has to be remembered is that during the good times when the stock market was booming, many cities and counties around the state quit paying into the retirement system, just like happened in the city of Fresno. For about a 9-year period, there were no contributions made by the city of Fresno into the retirement system because the system was so overfunded. Well, just like we are experiencing right now with the stock market downturn and the return on investments being low, well, you have retirement systems throughout the state and throughout the nation that are now suffering for those decisions years ago. And now they're having to pay out those pensions to people, which means that you have to increase the amount of contribution the city is making or the county is making to the retirement funds. Is it fair to punish or to demonize employees because many of these government agencies fail to pay into the retirement system for 9 or 10 years?
Yeah, question.
That is a very good question to ask. So, but that doesn't mean that we should just ignore it, because we cannot ignore it. And the pension system does need to be modified. Now, we took a proactive step many years ago, about 14 years ago, the city of Fresno created a second-tier system, which has saved the city of Fresno from having to make large contributions into the retirement system. So the city of Fresno was forward-thinking about 14 years ago and created a second tier. Now that's the discussion that they're having at the state level today, 14 years later.
And one other thing, you just talked about that you have been a law officer for 32 years working in the Fresno Police Department. But in the end, what you are is a public servant. And how do you feel about that? Because we touched on that a moment ago, that in tough times, all of a sudden the idea of being a public servant is not a noble profession.
Well, it has changed considerably over the years. I can tell you when I came into the profession of law enforcement, it is much different today than it was then. And I'll also tell you that, oftentimes I believe our police officers, maybe there isn't the level of appreciation that I'd like to see of them, because I understand what they go through. Being a public servant means you're willing to work nights, you're willing to work weekends, you're willing to work holidays, you're willing to spend time away from your family, and to be called out in the middle of the night for a homicide or some type of a emergency situation, that you're willing to sacrifice your personal life and you're willing to sacrifice your family's life for the good of the community. That's what a public servant is, and that's what I signed on for. That's what I've been doing over the last 32 years. I continue as a police chief to work 14-hour days. I don't have to, but that is what I choose to do. I work weekends. I work nights. And it's an example that I want to set for my employees, but it's also something that I feel a calling to do. Unfortunately, it takes a toll on you when you do that for a period of years, which is one of the reasons why I made the decision to do 10 years as a police chief and step away, because I understand the toll that the job can take. Two of our last four police chiefs had heart attacks in office. One of those died.
You saw that and you said, no for me, right?
Well, my wife told me I wasn't going to be one of them.
Okay.
So, but being a public servant is an incredible demand. But it also, at least being a police officer, I still believe today is the most noble profession there is. And you don't always get the pats on the back, but you can go home every night and know you made a difference.
Well, we're going to take a break right here, Chief. And if you have any questions for Chief Dyer, you can call in at 224-8989. That's 800 or 559-275-8989. Or join us online at kbpr.org. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Chevron and Avicennia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Our guest today, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. Now, let's talk about the budget. The last few years, everybody knows it's been tough for the city and the county. There have been a lot of cuts. How has that impacted your department?
Okay. Well, I mentioned earlier, over the last 2.5 to 3 years, we were at 1,322 employees. We now have 952 employees in the police department. So we've lost about 270 civilian employees. That's cadets, community service officers, dispatchers, crime scene bureau processors. And we've lost right about 100 officers now. And what that means is that our workload hasn't decreased. It continues to grow because our population continues to grow and the needs for law enforcement continue to grow. So we've had to make some very difficult decisions as we let people go. Certainly we're looking at increasing efficiencies within our department, increasing the use of volunteers. We've made some changes in terms of technology that have allowed us to do a better job or become more efficient. But when you do get to a point when you have to discontinue certain types of service. For example, when a person gets their car stolen or their vehicle broken into, we've had to change how we handle those calls. Those calls are now handled telephonically. That means that they're handled over the phone, generally by a light-duty police officer who's injured, and or the citizen is allowed to report those online, where they can self-report, and that goes into our system. Many of the vehicle burglaries we see out there today, people report them simply because of insurance purposes. But we do want people to report because it does help us identify crime trends. So there's been a lot of changes that we've had to make internally, and it's been a significant impact on us internally in terms of increased workload for other employees. There are areas that concern me with internal operations, for example, our property and evidence room. I don't like the fact that we're not able to purge evidence at the rate we would like to. And what that means is if you're not continuing to purge evidence or purge property, get rid of it, then you're going to have a lot of storage and then you have a tendency to lose property and evidence. We've been through that in our history. The other thing is in records, not being able to attach certain files or scan files, and then the potential is for you to lose very important information that are needed when you prosecute cases. The one area that bothers me the most is our inability to be able to respond to some of those calls that I talked about, vehicle burglaries and auto theft, or to be able to respond timely to other types of calls like residential burglaries or business burglaries.
Now, have you seen at all, I don't know what the latest stats are, but an increase in those kind of crimes that you just can't address like you used to, like home burglaries? I know it's a big discussion in my neighborhood, as well as auto thefts.
Well, burglaries increased this year 7.8% as of today.
That's a lot.
And that is a lot. And that's a combination of residential burglaries and business burglaries. The crime that's really skyrocketed, unfortunately, in our city in the last couple of years has been the crime of auto theft. And last year in the city of Fresno, auto theft increased by 40% over the previous year. Now, I think it's important to remember where we came from, because back in 1994, there were 13,580 cars stolen in our city. Since that time, we were able to reduce auto theft by about 76% up until 2009. And then what we saw was the trend going the other direction in increasing auto thefts. And that's when in 2010 we had a 40% increase. Right now, although we've made considerable progress, we're still up 22% in auto theft. Earlier in the year, we were up 60%. We created the Career Criminal Auto Theft Team. We've been focused on those that are the most prolific auto thieves in our city, making sure that we're able to not only apprehend them for auto theft, but charging with additional crimes like selling guns, crimes that we know where they're going to stay in jail and ultimately get longer sentences. And since we started that Career Criminal Auto Theft Team, we were averaging about 20 cars stolen a day. Today it's about 10 cars stolen a day. So we're going in the right direction again.
You just had to adjust.
We had to adjust, and we still really need some help in the criminal justice system. We have a jail that's overcrowded and prisoners being released, and we need—
That's got to be frustrating. I think on the other end as a law officer, the work that you might do to arrest someone and put them behind bars, and then to see that person, alleged criminal— released over and over and over again.
That's frustrating for all of us, frustrating for me, frustrating for the sheriff, for our officers in the field, because we are having to arrest people and see them being released in a very short period of time within a couple of hours. We had arrested one person. He was sentenced here recently, one of our most prolific auto thieves, and they ended up sentencing him to 5 years, 8 months in prison. But before he could be sentenced, we had arrested him 16 times. And he was early released. That's frustrating, not only for us, but for the victims. And that's why it's important that we shore up our jails, that we give that they are able to get the staffing levels that they need so we can open up those floors. So that is frustrating, but we are making progress. We cannot allow just because a part of the criminal justice system is not functioning appropriately, we can't discontinue our efforts.
But you talked about it's not only your department. You see it throughout the system. You see it in the police department, the sheriff's department, the district attorney's office. You know, what it comes down to is as a public, are we willing to pay for the services we receive? Because you can't talk about tax increases. Nobody wants to raise taxes. So if we don't raise any kind of revenue, then we have to face the consequences of seeing our level of services drop. So it becomes the fact that are we as a public, and you all out there can call in about this, are we as a public willing to pay for our services any longer, or do we, the whole idea of raising taxes? What's your take on that? Because it's got to be paid for some way.
Well, I see both sides. I know that hardworking folks out in the community feel that they pay their fair share of taxes. And in many respects, people feel that they pay too many taxes. Especially state and federal level, because that's where our taxes end up going for the most part, is to the federal government and to the state government. And unfortunately, there's only a few of those dollars. A small portion of those dollars come back to the local economy. And we end up in local government having to function on property tax and sales tax. And when people are not buying homes and there's foreclosures like we're seeing in our economy, there's fewer dollars for government. When people are tightening their belts and not going out and spending as much money buying cars and some of those things, then sales tax go down. And as a result, the monies that are available for local law enforcement, the district attorney's office, probation, the sheriff, those monies get decreased substantially. That's why our budgets have been impacted locally. So the debate has been, well, do you increase taxes during these times in order to increase service levels? Well, when people are already hurting and people are barely making their own bills, they're not in a mood to say, sure, I'll pay more taxes. There have been some communities that have done that, that have taxed themselves through a public safety tax, and that's the cities of Selma and Sanger and Reedley. They've went ahead and increased their sales tax so that they could enhance public safety. And one of the things that I've heard repeatedly from citizens is, well, before I sign on to increase my taxes, I want to know that government is running efficient. I want to know that there's no duplication of services, that the dollars I'm spending are being used wisely. And that's where there is a distrust of government, some at the local level, much at the state level, and a whole lot more at the federal level. And that's why people are reluctant. I don't think it's a matter of whether people are willing to pay more for services. It's a matter of them being convinced or not convinced that the monies they're already spending are being used wisely. And I fall in that category too.
But, you know, when you look at that, it's not just law enforcement. But because of our budget situation, we've seen increases in college tuition and other services. So in the end, you could say that we're going to pay one way or the other. We're going to pay either with having to pay more out of our pockets for those services, or we are going to have to pay as a consequence of not having a certain service. So we pay either way you look at it.
Well, that's certainly true when you look at our higher education. As we see in our local university here, they've been cut substantially. And the end result is higher tuition levels. And the students end up paying more. And the same holds true in our business, in law enforcement. When you decrease the number of officers you have on the streets, there's generally a corresponding increase in crime. And people are going to end up paying more insurance because their homes are being broken into or their cars are being stolen. And that general community ultimately ends up paying higher deductibles or more insurance, or maybe they don't report the crime at all and they end up accepting the loss and paying for it out of their own money or out of their own pocket. So, yeah, ultimately sometimes we do pay for it. And those are difficult decisions that people have to come to grips with. And I think that's the great debate today, at least in Congress. You see the divide between the Republicans and the Democrats. It's over, do we cut more expenses, our expenditures, or do we raise taxes, or do we do a combination of both? And I think that's been the age-old argument, and I think it always will be.
But how does the economy, what we're seeing now, how does that impact? Does it have an impact on crime?
It is a contributor, or it can be a contributor or influence crime. Doesn't always have to be, because I know there's been some times where you have an economic downturn where you don't have crime increases in certain areas. In the city of Fresno, where you have a 17% unemployment rate, where you have less than your educational levels are may not be as high as they are in other communities. There's a potential, especially when you have the diversity we have, the drug use that we have. When you start factoring in all of those other issues with the downturn in the economy, yes, you will have corresponding crime increases. And that's what we've been seeing here locally, and that's what many communities are going to experience as well.
Do you think – but it also puts a lot of people out of work. What we've seen now with the kind of economy, we have a lot of people out of work. And when you have a lot of people out of work, when you have a lot of people idle, that can't be good for a community.
No, it's never good for a community. I think when you look at communities that have very low – or countries that have very low unemployment rates, they have high levels of productivity and they have fewer problems, fewer crimes. And any time you have people that are unemployed, number one, they don't feel good about themselves. Oftentimes, we know in these difficult times that people turn to alcohol and drugs. And when they end up having an altered state of mind, they do things they normally wouldn't do. And sometimes that's commit crimes and sometimes violent crimes. So this economy, I have seen – I've seen this economy change people for the worse, at least in our business. When our officers are getting to a call, they're coming across people that are very angry, very frustrated, people that can't find a job, people that are unemployed, and people that are wanting to take their frustration and anger out on someone. And our officers oftentimes are the ones that they take it out on. So, yes, the economy can have an impact on crime and violence in a community.
Again, our guest today, Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer. He is taking your questions. And we've discussed a number of topics from pensions to the economy to budgets. And would like to hear from you. Give us a call at 275-8989 or 800-224-8989. Is there anything in your career you really didn't get to do that you'd like to do?
Well, I think as when you look back in a career, you can't do it all. But I have been able to do much. I've had some not only some local influence but state and national influence. I was able to serve as the president of the California Police Chiefs Association in 2008. That was something that I'm very proud of. I've been able to speak across this country on our efforts on gangs and traffic safety. We've received countless awards in terms of that. And I wish perhaps when I was a younger officer that I might have been able to spend a little bit more time working in other units like homicide. But what ends up happening in your career is you choose. Are you going to move horizontally in the organization and work in a lot of investigative units, or are you going to advance in the organization? And that's what I chose to do at one point in my career. So I did not get to do a lot of those things that I wish I could have done. But had I done that, more than likely I wouldn't have advanced in the organization to where I am today.
You know, we were talking a moment ago, you were talking about just the life of a police officer and what it's like on any given night. What can it be like on any given night?
Well,
or any given day?
I can tell you that no two nights are alike in the life of a police officer that's out in the field. And no two calls are alike. You know, I can countless times you can hear officers say out in the field, well, I've never experienced that one before. And so it's exciting. It's when an officer goes to work at night, and I know it's cliche, but they don't know whether or not they're going to go home at the end of their shift. And there aren't a lot of professions where people say that. And so when our officers do go to work, there is a little bit of a sense of anxiousness on their part. And because they know that they are the ones that people are calling when they're in their most desperate time. We're the ones that are called when no one else can handle the situation. And these officers are frequently, and more so today than I can remember, going after individuals and confronting individuals that are armed with firearms. So it is a job that has a high stress level because of that. You have to be on constant alert. Every traffic stop you make, every person you detain, there's a potential. There's always a potential for that person to turn on an officer. So it's a high stress level.
You know, you're the interim chief now as the department goes about the process of, finding your replacement. But we know that there is a lot more coming for Jerry Dyer. Have you kind of thought about what you want to do? You know, there's been much speculation, and I know you've heard it before, that many people think that you would run for a political office. And you talked a little bit about what we're seeing in Congress today and the battle. I mean, as an elected official, How do you feel about the whole role of the art of compromise and working together to try to get something done?
Well, I don't have a plan in terms of where I'm going to go once I do leave here. There's been a lot of folks that have gotten in touch with me to offer their advice, and one of the things that I've found is that there has not been a shortage of an opinion in terms of what folks think I should do once I retire or once I leave law enforcement. But I have considered some of those things. I have looked at Congress. I've had some discussions with people about what that would entail. And I've also talked to some other folks on some other avenues, but none that I want to talk about publicly, really, because once you do start talking about those things publicly, it starts spinning.
It's done.
It's done. It starts spinning. So I'm trying to keep every door open, and because I, you know, my philosophy has always been never close a door before God opens it, and I want to make sure that whatever I do, it is God's will, and it's something that is going to allow me to be significant. I don't want to just do something for the purpose of doing it. I want to be significant in wherever I go, and I want to know it's God's will for my life.
And with that, the second part of that question is, I'd just like to have your take on what we are seeing, not just in Washington, but in state capitals, with the country that's so divided politically. How do you kind of, you know about compromise and you know about working together. How do you kind of get people to do that? And why is it important?
Well, I think it's a shame that people are divided based on parties. I've always felt at the state level and at the federal level that the solutions are there, but the political will is not. And it's because people are controlled by parties. And unfortunately, it becomes politics over people. And the people are the ones that end up losing. I looked at what occurred this year in Congress, where certain individuals were not willing to come together, which almost caused the demise of our country, us not having a budget. And we saw the ripple effect on what that had. And the truth of the matter was, the reason that I believe that the stock market did what it did, the reason that the other countries lost confidence in us wasn't because we couldn't pay our bills. It was because they felt that we couldn't come together as a country to make the needed decisions that needed to be made at that time. And when you have a country that is divided, that's a country that will fall. And I believe that's what's happened to our country today, whether it's at the state level or at the national level. Politics have become priority over people. And we have to change that. I had hoped that redistricting would do some of that, but I'm not certain. And maybe it's a step in the right direction. But you know what we're seeing now is even bickering over that and how the boundaries and the lines are drawn. And at the state level, they cannot come to an agreement. There's people that are willing to place roadblocks in the way, and so it's frustrating. I know it's frustrating for all of us as Americans, and that's why I think you're starting to see more and more common people get involved in politics. Starting to see more and more people that are running for Congress that never would have ever thought about that because they're frustrated with the way the country's being run. They're frustrated with how our state's being run, and they want to do something about it. And they're willing to sacrifice. They're willing to have their reputations tarnished through an election in order to get in that position to where they can help move this country forward or this state forward.
Well, we're just going to have to leave it on that note. Thank you so much, Chief Dyer, for coming in and joining us in this conversation. It was a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and we'll be right back. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, the Fresno Grand Opera is going into its 14th season, and here to talk to us about what we can expect is Ron Eichmann. He's the general director, and T. Nguyen, he is the associate director. You know, I had a chance to take a look at what's coming up, and it looks just fantastic, starting off with Fresno's own Audra McDonald.
We are so excited to have Audra back here. It's been 5 years since she's performed in the market, and we've got the benefit of a brilliant associate director here, T. Nguyen, who's helped design a show especially for Fresno. She's going to be performing with the Opera Orchestra. It's an incredible evening, opportunity to see her at her finest, and I think it'll be really exciting for our market here.
You were saying, T. Nguyen, you're not only the associate director, but you're also a musician, and you're putting this show together centered around Audra. What can we expect?
Well, she usually travels with her rhythm section, and so we just thought that she won a Tony Award to being on Broadway, and she's such an incredible voice, and we'd love to hear her do a lot more of her Broadway hits and the Broadway pieces that we all know and love. And so we are surrounding her rhythm section with the opera orchestra, and we're going to be listening to some most popular Broadway pieces that she would love to perform for us as well.
And who else is on the list for this season?
Well, we just have, I think, what is an extraordinary lineup. It runs the gamut from opera to concerts to ballet. Our opera season opens with an incredible production of Carmen the end of January. We are collaborating with Valley Performing Arts Council this year to be producing Nutcracker, first time in the market in a long time with live orchestral accompaniment, a world-class production. Renee Fleming, who is easily the world's leading soprano, will be on our stage in March. So really excited about what the offerings are this year.
Tell me a little bit about the partnership that you form with the Valley Performing Arts Council and StageWorks.
Yeah, we really believe that there's great strength in partnership and collaboration in our market, and there's opportunities to inspire a new level of programming here. And so two of our partners, Valley Performing Arts Council and StageWorks Fresno, have been producing great quality work for the past several years, and we thought the collaboration with the opera company would provide another level of quality to the performances that we think our audience will be inspired by. So, for example, with the Nutcracker, we'll be introducing for the first time actually in North America surtitles to the ballet. So the audience will get to watch the ballet and they'll get to read text about the storyline that is happening in front of them, which is a component of opera that we've been able to introduce into dance. And we think our audience will love that and will feel a real connection to the performance for first time in perhaps in a long time. And then I know T can tell you a little bit about what's going on with our partnership with StageWorks Fresno.
Oh, that really looks exciting.
Yeah, I think theater and opera is very, very closely connected. And it just makes perfect sense for us to start to look at other art forms and to incorporate into what we have to offer. Going back a little bit to the Nutcracker real quickly, we're also going to build a new orchestra for that as well. So that's very exciting. So it'll be a live orchestra down there in the pit. And I think that would add a lot to the quality of the Nutcracker as well.
And StageWorks, they already have a performance.
Yes, they're doing right now. They're in the middle of the Ragtime production. And so
I've heard nothing but great things about that.
Yes, it's terrific. I think Joel Abels is a brilliant director, and this incredible local talent that's involved in that production as well. And I think it's a great show.
And we also, with that, we have an opportunity really to try to showcase more of our local talent.
We do. Joel has done a fantastic job in gathering the best of our talent here locally, assembling them on the stage and delivering great work. There's an interesting connection between Joel and actually our opening season performance, Audra McDonald. They went to high school together here in Fresno.
Oh, great. What a connection.
Part of our programming this year includes a production of Masterclass. There will be a collaboration between our company and StageWorks Fresno as well. That production, actually, Audra McDonald won a Tony Award for her performance in the Masterclass in 1996. And really interestingly, from our perspective, we will be engaging Jackie Antaramian to play the role of Maria Callas, which is the lead role in the Masterclass. And Jackie's from Fresno, and she's singing, or performing, I should say, that role on Broadway right now in New York. So Fresno will be getting a Fresnan returning back to our market who is singing or performing again directly from Broadway in Masterclass. So another example of real great
the
collaboration.
Benefits, the benefits of growing your own, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds like an exciting season. And also, we have the opportunity. They have restored the Severance Theater. So it's a great locale for this, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I don't know if you've seen the show or not, but the set is wonderful. And the performers are right in front of you. The way Joel designed the whole show is really a terrific experience for everybody.
Now, what we're seeing really, the Fresno Grand Opera and what you're able to do and the level of performances we get, you know, every year it seems to get better and better. What does it take to really keep this at the level that you have it now and to grow it?
Well, I think most importantly, it is a continuing appreciation and knowledge that we have a market that can support the kind of program we are producing there. So our strength as an institution, it really is our audience. Our donors are very important to us, but it really is the folks that come and attend. And that's what we look to inspire in the selection of programming for the year, to provide vast opportunities of varied interests, of representations that we think our community will be inspired by and want to participate with us.
And before we have to wrap up here, I want to know, what do people need to be aware of and need to take a look at when it comes to getting in on this season? You've got a great lineup, so I would assume that they might want to, you know, get their tickets now and they can go online and do that, or
absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. I think they should get their tickets early because it's reserved seating and you really want great seats, especially for Audra and Renee Fleming and all our productions.
The simplest way to join us is to, if there's computer access, is to visit our website, which is fresnograndopera.org. We have a very user-friendly system that allows people to actually select their own seats online and determine the price point that best fits their budget and where they would like to sit at the hall as well. So it's very easy to be a participant with the company.
Right, that's one thing you do. I have to give it to you. You've been very, very inclusive in trying to get people to come in and just experience the Fresno Grand Opera, and you've got a great season coming up. Thank you both for coming in today. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been our pleasure. One of you.
Thank you. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions, and you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.